Hello and welcome to The Stooshy, the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media. My name is Christopher Finn. I'm the producer of this podcast, so you don't usually hear my voice. Today, you have an unusual host, and so therefore, indeed, this is an unusual episode, but that's because this is an unusual year. The upcoming elections in May are arguably the most significant in the entire history of devolution in Scotland. And this week, DC Thompson Media has launched not only its first-of-a-kind election hub on thecourier.co.uk and pressandjournal.co.uk, bringing you analysis, insight and even daily live video broadcasts from our dedicated politics team, but also our news brand's manifesto has launched this week for how we'll help you be better briefed ahead of these most important of elections. And so on this unusual episode, I'm joined by David Clegg, the editor of The Courier, and Frank O'Donnell, the editor-in-chief of The Press and Journal. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I do say gentlemen as well, which is an interesting point. Like, we should acknowledge that we are three white middle-class men sitting around making a podcast, which is, frankly, a little on the nose for 2020 and 2021. But we should say that, you know, the coverage we give in our newspapers and the politics team that will be bringing you that coverage is more diverse than the three talking heads you'll hear in this podcast would suggest. Now, part of bringing more voices into this podcast is that throughout this episode, so that we don't just have two people agreeing with each other for half an hour, we have got some voices from the public in the communities that we serve. So we sent some reporters out into Aberdeen and out into Dundee to gather some thoughts about the role of the media in an election year. But before we get into any of that, a little context. David, there'll be some folks joining this podcast who are not familiar with our brands as we are. Give us a little pot history of The Courier and the patch that you serve.
So The Courier traditionally has been the daily newspaper for Tayside and Fife. We publish in numerous editions each day. At the minute, there's three editions. We cover Dundee, Angus, Perth and Kinross, and Fife. So it has been the centre of the news environment for this region, and at the very heart of the community for decades, and it continues to do that. It is a legacy brand, of course, so it's a very strong print product, has been for many years, foundation stone for the city of Dundee in particular, what created that great phrase of jute jam and journalism. The Courier was the journalism in those three J's of Dundee and continues to be so. We have, in recent years, of course, like every other newspaper, branched off into different platforms. So our website is a massive focus of what we do now, as we'll be discussing today. And we have all kinds of things that wouldn't have been dreamt about in the Courier Conference even just 20 years ago. Video broadcasts, podcasts like this one, all types of different content. But at its heart, I think the central mission of The Courier remains what it has always been, which is to inform and entertain the people of Tayside and Fife with news, features, sport, and all types of content that they want, and that is what we continue to produce. It's a brilliant team, and one I'm very proud to lead.
So David's voice will be familiar to some more long-term listeners of The Stooshy, although he hasn't graced the airwaves for some months now. But a voice unfamiliar to listeners will be Frank O'Donnell. Frank, you're the editor-in-chief of The Press and Journal. Tell us a little bit about that paper and the patch it covers.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. Press and Journal is the biggest selling regional newspaper in the UK.
We're coming hard at you though, Frank.
coming at you. Yeah, and that's great. I think, you know, both papers have, in terms of print, have been doing really well. A long running brand, one of the oldest newspapers in the UK as well. High levels of trust among its readership. A diverse community as well. If you think about the Northeast and Aberdeen, that's very, very different to parts of the Highlands and Islands, which you also served. The phrase that I was given when I joined last May as editor, Chris, was the patch is bigger than Belgium, which gives you some sort of sense of scale.
You normally measure these things in terms of the area of Wales. I haven't heard of Belgium as a standard unit of area measurement.
Yeah, indeed. It's a Belgium plus a little bit. So yeah, diverse and vast. Going through, obviously, very, very strong in terms of local news and sport and business, incredibly important to P&J readers, farming as well, but diversifying a lot in terms of our content into different areas as we move forward digitally. I echo exactly what David says in terms of purpose. I would probably say broadly, I tell my team our purpose is to improve the welfare of the communities we serve. We need to stand up for our audiences consistently and relentlessly.
And we've seen that a lot, even with recent campaigns, even as we record around the city centre in Aberdeen with the proposed closure, for example, of John Lewis. Now, David, I said at the top of the show, this is arguably the most significant election in the history of devolution in Scotland. Why? Why is this such a key election in May this year?
So before becoming editor of The Courier, I was a political journalist for just around 10 years. And what I can tell you from that experience is at every election, journalists always say this is the most important election there's ever been. I think actually when we say it this time, we've got a pretty credible argument to make. And I'll give you a version of why it could be. The first election I covered was 2011, the Scottish Parliament election. I was political editor of this newspaper. Just appointed a few months before the election, thrown into it, didn't really know what was going on. Big steep learning curve. But it was a very different world then, even though it was only 10 years ago, not just in the media climate, talking about the digital transformation that The Courier and The Press and Journal has been going through, but the political transformation that Scotland's been going through those 10 years as well. The first story I remember writing was an opinion poll saying Labour were heading back to power. And that was a few months before the 2011 election. Then, of course, we had this massive majority for the SNP, this unprecedented and unimagined, really, with the thought the electoral system couldn't produce such a result, and it did. And that meant, crucially, that a referendum on Scottish independence was guaranteed. And I think everyone understands quite the transformation that that electoral event had on Scotland and its politics. So we now have the domination of the SNP. And while that returned a no result, I think most people are of the view that it feels like an unresolved question on Scotland's future still. So there's that element of things. The other thing that happened, of course, is the UK then left the European Union. So Scotland is no longer an EU member. And there's unresolved issues about that, which we're seeing discussed and debated in this campaign as well. And then, of course, COVID. So as you referenced at the start, it's been a very unusual year. And not just Scotland, but the world has changed. How we live our lives has changed. And how we think about what we want from the world in the future has changed dramatically over the last 12 months, I think. And politicians of all stripes have been wrestling with that, and there's no different in Scotland. So I think I haven't even mentioned the psychodrama of Alex Salmond and Nicola Sturgeon, which is probably a whole separate podcast or indeed series of podcasts, and we'll not get a chance to go into the detail of that. But I think what we have crystallizing around this election then is some really important issues about the future of Scotland, whether that be constitutional, whether that be political, or whether that be philosophical in many ways.
Or even whether that be about the sort of day-to-day, right? I mean, that's one of the things that was thrown up by the polling work that your teams have been doing with Servation. You know, a lot of what the conversations that are the people in our communities that we serve want to have are not particularly about these big constitutional questions, but they're about mental health, they're about local communities, right?
Yeah, I think Frank's going to come on a little bit to talk about the manifestos that we've published this week, one in The Courier and one in The Press and Journal. And we conducted certainly the most extensive piece of research that I can remember into how voters are feeling, not just our readers, but voters across our regions are feeling. And the results of that were very dark and sobering reading. People are very worried, they're anxious, they're concerned for the future, and they have a whole host of concerns. And I think that is another reason why the election is so important.
Yeah, I mean, I think we did think the Constitution was going to come out as a big issue, and it, you know, we should acknowledge it is for a lot of people. But when you looked at it, some of the issues at the top of people's agenda were around recovery from the pandemic, housing, mental health, state of roads, poverty, antisocial behaviour. These were the things that were actually top of people's agenda. And I suppose in some ways, those who think about the Constitution a lot might say, well, this is what will fix it all. You know, the constitutional change will be the solution. But right now, in terms of, you know, what do you want sorted out of this election, those were the things that were very much in the forefront of people's minds.
And so, digging that wee bit more, David, I remember, so as I say, I'm the producer of this show. I'm not usually on it, but I'm there in the background listening to everything that's said on every episode of The Station. I remember when we started this back in December of 2019, ahead of the general election, a lot of the conversations that you led, David, as chair and host then, as anchor, were around, you know, that notion of whether this is, whether the Holyrood elections would be a proxy vote for independence, whether they would be a popularity poll for Nicola Sturgeon, or whether they would be about policy and the day-to-day nitty-gritty of people's lived experiences. How do you view that now that we're out, that we're well past the general election, and we're now in the absolute thick of the Holyrood elections, where do you think that the decisions will be taken around the parties people will be voting for in both polls?
So there's a few layers to that, which I'll try and unpack a little because it's quite complicated. And I think one of the important things to note at the beginning of that actually is when we launched this podcast in December 2019, it was about the UK general election. And that was an issue that on a national level was dominated by Brexit and the character of Boris Johnson in some ways as Prime Minister. And in Scotland, it had the independence issue mapped on top of it as well. And we had a lot of conversations. We were going daily at the beginning for the podcast. We had lots of conversations, you know, what are the issues on the doorstep? What are you hearing? What will people be thinking about when they come to vote? Now, there's also a media element to this, because in my experience as a political journalist, you hear a lot. This research that we have commissioned and published this week is more extensive, more thorough, and more, I think, impressive than many of the other similar types of studies that's done into voter priorities. But it's not new that they don't tend to put the Constitution to the forefront in the same way that the national conversation puts the Constitution to the forefront. In a Westminster election, the issues that they care about aren't really sitting at Westminster. Because of the devolved settlement in Scotland, the list that Frank's just mentioned there, housing, education, health service, job prospects, that stuff that all already sits with the Scottish Parliament in Edinburgh and has done since 1999, and has subsequently been augmented by extra powers through the First Scotland Act and then the one after the independence referendum. So in a Westminster election, the issues that really matter to the people are not being decided by that election in some ways. So this is an election where those issues, there really is agency in your vote, because who you vote for in this are the people who are going to be able to influence those decisions. But there's a media element to this as well, because as a political journalist in my previous job, one of the things that I was wrestling with, and you wrestle with as a newspaper editor in some ways as well, is people are telling us that their main priorities are not what are filling the newspapers every day. The lobby of the political journalists in the Scottish Parliament file more stories about independence than anything else. They don't file as many stories about job prospects or education or the health service. So whenever we're reflecting on our practice here and when we're putting together our political coverage, and I think it was Frank's idea to put together these manifestos, and I think it was a brilliant idea, because what it does is focuses the mind, it clarifies and crystallizes what we want to do with our journalism during this campaign, because we don't only want to nudge the candidates and the political parties towards the issues that people are telling us they care about, we want to make sure that our journalism is focused on that too.
So these manifestos then, Frank, they sit on the Press and Journal and the Courier's sites. They were published in the papers as well as part of a special pull-out section. We've established, I think, hopefully, why this election matters. And so what will we be doing? What will our news brands be doing at DC Thompson Media, across the Courier, Press and Journal, and all of our news brands, to ensure people are well informed when they head to the ballot box?
I think the first thing is we've tried to scorecard the Scottish Government on what it's done in the last 5 years, because I think that's an important place to start, is to say, okay, it's absolutely up to you how you vote, and that's exactly how it should be. Our titles are independent, but it's our job to give you the information. So first of all, let's look back and and see how the Scottish government has done on its policy promises from last time around. That is quite difficult with the COVID-19 pandemic, because that has thrown some things askew. But and then you know, secondly, it's about us asking the questions on these issues and us not getting caught up in that vortex of finger pointing between Westminster and Holyrood, finger pointing between parties. What's the latest polling? Is, you know, are we going to have a majority or not? I mean, those are all interesting things, but we've got to remember that we are recovering from the worst economic crisis in the last 100 years. And therefore, what are we going to do about it? What are people going to do with regard to education? How are we going to get our mental health services back? You know, how are we going to make housing affordable? How are we going to make sure our infrastructure is right? You know, up here in the north, we want to make sure that we have the right broadband infrastructure, however that happens to be. What is being done about that? Not who is better at communicating in a certain way or who said what. Or, I mean, yes, of course, these things are interesting, but ultimately, what is going to affect people's lives is what governments actually do. And we have to keep coming back to that point. We have to keep ensuring that we do. And this research gives us an empirical grounding, a solid grounding to say, this is actually what our readers want, rather than you pushing some agenda. No, the agenda we're pushing is what our readers said that they want us to talk about. And so I think from that point of view, I think it's incredibly important that we return to those issues.
It's interesting. We talk often in the conversations we have within DC Thompson about serving our communities. And I guess that can ring a little hollow to people in our communities. You know, it might seem like a trite thing to say, but you've just restated there, Frank, and at the top of the show as well, about the role that our news brands have, literally to champion and to stand up for the communities that we're honoured to serve. And a way of bringing the voices of those communities into this podcast, as I mentioned earlier, is the Vox Pops that we did before we recorded. We sent some reporters out into the community to record some of the views that our communities have about the role of our news brands and the broader media apparatus as well as part of that. Now, Frank and David, you haven't heard these yet. I have. I know what's coming up, but you haven't heard these yet. So there's four broad areas I want to touch on. The first is bias. The second is, or rather, independence, if you'd rather put a more positive spin on it. The second is the notion of influence, the influence that authority can have in helping people to understand where to vote. The great big elephant in the room is social media. You know, the world we operate in, the political discourse, especially we saw in America with Trump, is dictated by social media algorithms. And then lastly, I want to touch on tribalism. So we're going to play you a couple of clips around independence and around bias, and then we'll get you to respond to those. Okay, gents, here's your first one.
Yeah, I do tend to find that the mainstream media is very biased. There's there's very little unbiased within media at the moment. They take a certain stance and that's it. There's no listening to debate or any sort of resolution within current climate.
That was Scott, who was interviewed. He's from Dundee, who's interviewed in Dundee. So David, that one to you. This notion that the mainstream media, which we are unashamedly a part of, that it's a biased organisation.
Yes, I mean, I think this is something that news organisations across the world are wrestling with, and it has been a constant presence in my career, this idea that there's a level of bias, that there's some kind of hidden agenda being played out, that, you know, I have been accused of being in the pay of every political party in Scotland, with the exception of the Liberal Democrats. No one's ever accused me of being a Liberal Democrat for some reason. I'm not sure why that is.
You need to mark that one off your top trumps, right?
But when I was the political editor of the Courier, Tory was the epithet that was thrown at me most frequently. Then I moved to the Record and I was a Labour stooge. Then the Record seemed, or there was an impression from some people in Labour quarters that the Record was too friendly with the SNP. So I had people ringing my editor to ask if I had been co-opted by the nationalists. And ultimately, the truth of the matter is it's no one's ever told me what to write. or attempted to influence anything I put in any of the newspapers I've ever worked for. And my view, certainly, of the organization that we represent now is that there's no interference at all with the political content. The only people who decide what goes in the pages and website of the Courier and the Press and Journal are the people who write it and the people who edit it. The other thing that I think that podcasts like this and other initiatives to try and explain how the process works, what we're trying to do, how we do it, I think that's something that this industry has been very bad at. The mainstream media in general has not been good at that. There was a view, certainly, in the past that you just produce your content and never explain, apologize, or get into a dialogue, really. And that was a great mistake, because even if you listen to Scott there, mainstream media as a phrase has negative connotations for him. Now, he didn't mention what particular newspaper he was talking about or which broadcaster he was talking about or exactly where he was talking there, but he seems, in his view, we've been lumped together and there's a malign presence there. And I think that while I disagree with his premise, I don't think it's true, and it's certainly not true of the Courier. I think equally as journalists, we have to reflect upon the fact that if this is a widely held perception, even if it's a minority view, it's certainly a view that you hear with quite a level of repetition and frequency. What faults of ours has allowed that perception to develop, and how can we counter them? And I think being transparent about the process is a very important part of that.
I agree. Here's one for you, Frank. This is Heather from Kirkcaldy on the same topic.
Definitely. I think it has a huge impact on how people vote, because if it's got any bias in any way, any type of media towards one party or another, it's going to speak in a way that will make it seem like they are doing either well or not so well. And if that's skewed in any way, then when people are reading that, they're going to believe it as the truth. And then if they have a belief to a certain party, then they might not say when another party is doing something well or agrees or disagrees. And I think that's incredibly powerful. We trust the media to be telling us the truth. And it might be that they are telling part of it, but if they're not telling the whole story and just putting it into that bit of context, then it can definitely have a huge influence and an impact on what we perceive and what we believe is true about different political parties.
Yeah, it is incredibly hard to get it right, to be perfectly unbiased. But to echo what David said, it's we strive to do the very best we can. And I think it's important to state, no one's ever asked me ever as an editor, which I'm now 9 years as an editor and various different titles, no one's ever asked me to write about something because of political bias or to not write anything about something because it's political bias. That's not my experience at all. I do think that there is a problem with trust, and it is incredibly important that we do everything we can to address this. We need to stand apart from other digital media so that we are seen as a source of information that people can rely on. And how do we do that? We've got to be as transparent as possible about who our journalists are, where they've worked before, how we go about reporting, why we don't report on certain topics. And I don't think we do that very well. I think, as David said, we've been rather closed. To give you just a little example of that, we're fortunate in that we're in a business where we get immediate feedback from our customers. So that on the bottom of websites, people can comment on articles, on social media, people can comment. And, I have heard journalists in the past when I've talked about this say, oh, well, you wouldn't want to pay any attention to that, as if the comments on the bottom of the stories are something not to be considered to be valid. But, if you were another business, if we made carpets for a living and we wanted to get feedback on our latest Axminster, we'd probably have to wait 9 months and do a focus group survey. And yet we have this immediate reaction coming through, and we don't really see it as valid. And I think that's because, you know, we don't jump in, we don't try and shape the conversation, we don't explain what we're doing, we don't explain what we're not doing. And we need to be better at that. It's incredibly important that we underpin everything we do by being as open as we can. Otherwise, we just become another voice in the mix.
Because one of the things that we did as an industry by vacating that space, by not addressing those issues, by letting them fester, is we allowed a little digital ecosystem to grow where you can find things that are just completely inaccurate, have no resemblance to the real world or how journalism or media organizations operate, flourish to an extent, you know, to get some purchase. And that has ultimately undermined trust in the media. And I think we've seen what that can lead to in the political world. There was some discussion recently about there doesn't seem to be the same accountability in politicians. What does a resignation matter these days? I'm not going to cite any particular example, but there's a general sense in the abroad, in the UK and more widely, that scandals that would have ended political careers in the past no longer do so. And why is that? It's because the world's became more tribal, so people aren't really interested in right and wrong, and they just want to support their political parties like football teams. And there's an element of that, and I think some of that's driven by social media, and that's another conversation. But an element of it also is that people just dismiss the reporting of facts that they don't like, and that's been allowed to happen because of this undermining of the media. Now, I think the people who have behaved very dangerously there are politicians and others who undermine the media knowingly to suit their own agenda. That is a very dangerous situation that is developed in across the civilized world, really. But again, the media needs to take responsibility for that, because part of the reason it is allowed to happen is because of malpractice in certain elements of the media, which of course we knew happened, but also the fact that we didn't rebut the nonsense that was being talked about us in other quarters, and we should have been more proactive in doing that. I'm afraid in some quarters, I think they thought they were too good to get down and defend themselves in that way, because they thought the people that were saying these things were just not worth listening to, as Frank has suggested there. So I think we need to learn the lessons of that, and it has to shape how we have to reflect on that, and it has to shape how we practice journalism in the future.
You talk about the vacuum that's created there by the media, traditional media organizations pulling away and allowing that to fester. And yet this is still a business that has influence over people, and it's a responsibility I'm sure that you both and your teams take incredibly seriously. Some of the folk we talked to on the street talked about that level of influence that the media can have. Here's, first of all, Callum in Aberdeen.
I mean, understand it, but what, so there's a lot of information and material out there that you can use to understand how to vote. In terms of influence and how you vote, the media has the biggest influence on how people vote nowadays, because that's how we gain information. Depending on the source depends on what kind of information you're going to see, and I think that the recent issues in the Scottish Parliament has really kind of exacerbated where different points of information come from different sources.
And then, second of all, let's go straight into Sarah from Anstruther.
I think the media is a tool that should be used appropriately in regards to an election, because people can be really easily influenced by what they see on TV or in newspapers or anything like that. Can really change people's opinions if someone of authority is speaking on media in general.
And so those are a couple of quite young voices, and they're still talking about the media as having influence. Now, the traditional narrative, of course, is that young people are increasingly not engaging with traditional media organizations. Frank, do you see that?
Well, I certainly hope that media has influence, but I would like to draw a distinction between we're not telling people how to vote. You know, broadly, I suppose there are some papers who very much, wear the rosette on their masthead. Everyone knows who they are, and that's fine. You know, those are papers that are probably very comfortable for those people who read them. They read a lot of pieces that fit their worldview. It confirms their prejudices. It's not really my view of what a newspaper should be about. So, you get that warm, familiar feeling, I hope, with the Courier and the P&J because they're local, because they reflect the issues that matter. But when it comes to what you think, I want people to feel slightly uncomfortable sometimes about what they read, because we have to challenge people. We have to get them to think differently on certain issues rather than all the time just trying to preserve the status quo. So yes, I want my paper to be influential, but ultimately I want people to be able to make up their own mind based on a range of opinions and diverse voices that they see through in our news pages, in our comment sections, in business, and so on. So it's not about making people feel comfortable from front to back.
Yeah, and I think just to carry on from what Frank's saying there, yes, of course we want our newspapers and our brands to be influential, but it's an influential platform for debate. It's not an attempt to pursue or promote one outcome or the other in that debate. It's facilitating it and informing our readers about the issues in play at it. Now, that's very difficult, and digital actually gives us a lot more opportunities for that because we have so many more ways that we can get into the issues. You know, I think about the data journalism that we've been doing in the last year, the newscast that we launched this week. There's all kinds of new ways. It gives us different angles and a more rounded perspective of the political climate. But, you know, anyone can come in and see one 400-word news story and think, well, that's not fully reflective of the debate, and they may well be right about that. And it's also true of the columnists and the opinion, in that I think this isn't a bit of a impact on social media and an antidote to it, that social media bubbles, the fact that the algorithm serves you up more of the same, the fact that you can select your followers list so it's only people who agree with you, that whose content you're seeing. A really important part of journalism is to present you with opposing views, to challenge you in that way so that you have a more rounded view of the world. And one thing that you hear, Frank's been a newspaper editor longer than me, but one of the things that I've been surprised about is you do hear quite often people writing to you quite angry because a columnist had an opinion they don't agree with. I think that's quite a new thing, that people are saying, don't say I disagreed with this opinion and here's why. They say, how dare you publish an opinion I disagree with?
Yeah, I get a lot of that, and it deflates me because I think, actually, I was hoping that you would I was hoping that a constituency of our readers would disagree with that, but at least you understand where that person's coming from, or you understand where other people who think like that person maybe understands where they're coming from. But I think there is a lesson in there for us as well, because one thing I've realized is that we badge things, news and comment, but I don't think we do it properly. And I think a lot of people, if you think about it, particularly people who are engaging with our brand online, they may be coming through social media, they may, you know, they're clicking on articles, they're not necessarily completely paying attention. And they might click on a piece, read it, it's strident opinion. They think it's a news piece and they become upset because they think it's biased, because they don't understand maybe the difference between news and comment, or they haven't seen that. Or as I say, we haven't labeled it enough. So I think we can do more there to be clear about that. But yeah, I mean, ultimately, it does deflate me a little bit when someone says, how dare you print something I disagree with? Because I think I've actually done my job there.
Well, let's cheer ourselves up a little bit. Let's hear from Ross from Dundee for our second to last clip. This cheers me because Ross hasn't made up his mind. And the clip will end on with somebody who's made up their mind before they've even heard an argument. So let's start with the positive. Here's Ross from Dundee. But he's talking more broadly here about social media, right? And that's a thing that's been underwriting a lot of what we've been talking about today and in the conversations around news for a decade or more. Here's Ross from Dundee.
I don't know about my decision because I haven't made up my mind yet. And I've personally made the decision to come off of social media, for example. I do read a political magazine, and that probably has some influence. But I think the main question with this one is social media. I think that, well, there's good evidence that we're becoming a lot more polarised, and that people are, it's almost like Catholics and Protestants again. We're getting into these political tribes, and I think social media has a lot to answer for in that regard. I think that I believe the way that these things work is that they have algorithms built into them, right? That feed you more of what you like, and there's good evidence that we're moving to a more polarized political reality, and I think that's damaging the ability for us to talk to each other like reasonable adults about the middle ground and where we generally agree is the center. But I think a lot of political debate now has been drowned out by extremists, particularly on the radical left, but the radical right is certainly there. I think it would be a really healthy thing for political discourse if we were able to somehow stop social media algorithms from polarizing people into unhealthy mindsets that don't permit them to have reasonable dialogues with people with whom they disagree. It's very important. So I don't know about myself, it probably does. I'm like just like everyone else, but I certainly think does the media influence the average person? Does the media influence most people? And does the media influence the outcome of political and the nature of political discourse? Absolutely does. Particularly social media is a big problem, and I think I don't think I would be in favour of government intervention. That would be a problem as well. So I don't know what the answer is. But your question was, does it impact? And yes, I think it absolutely does.
Wasn't that terrific? That was a very considered opinion from...
Should have had him on the show from the start.
Absolutely, yeah.
Ross, if you're listening, mate, could you give me a call? We'll get you on next week. Mm-hmm. But he makes a serious point, not just about the influence of social media, but also about solutions to this. Now, I'm not suggesting we're going to solve the issue of regulation of social media in the 5 minutes we have left in this podcast, but it has been a challenge, and it's set a context against which you've both been operating for your newspapers. So, David, first of all, what has the legacy been of the impact of social media on the way you and your journalists do your job?
It certainly made it more challenging. I think there's certainly been benefits on, you know, how we can promote our work and promote ourselves, and there's elements of that which isn't maybe quite so relevant here. I think the abuse of journalists has been it's made it a much more challenging job, one that requires more of a duty of care than there would have been in the past, when green ink letters were the most abuse that journalists get. Now we have our reporters getting very vicious personal abuse straight to their phones from strangers on a daily basis. So having to manage that is obviously is a challenge. In some ways, though, it also helps keep us honest, I think. I think we should not be blind to the benefits that often you see criticism on social media that is reasonable and has validity to it, and that can allow you to reflect on how you maybe approach those types of stories in the future. But just to draw the point from that, which really struck me there, was I think the element as far as covering politics is concerned is that it has polarized politics. I think there's no doubt that politics is more polarized, and I equally think there's no doubt that social media has played a large part of that, because it turns politics into a war, it turns it into a clash. And just one, I feel like I've picked on Richard Leonard, the former Scottish Labour leader, a few times in this podcast, and I'm about to do so again, so hopefully he'll forgive me. But one of the more depressing things from a senior politician I've heard in recent years was Richard Leonard said he didn't have any friends who was a Conservative, not a single friend who supported the Conservatives, and wouldn't have one. And if you accept that premise, that you can't be a supporter of the Labour Party and have a friend who's a supporter of the Conservative Party, it means that political debate can't be an exchange of ideas or an attempt to change minds. All it can be is a war of attrition. Now, I don't really want to be reporting on a war of attrition. I want to be reporting on a exchange of ideas. So that's one of the elements that social media has done. And I think one of the elements of the manifesto that we've not discussed is there's a call in there for civility in politics and this idea that we want to have a debate where people can safely put their views across and have them listened to and respected and challenged. So I think one of the important things our journalism can do is try and foster that atmosphere again, because it has been lacking. Let's be frank.
In the manifesto, it actually talks about, David McDougall uses this phrase, which I really love, which is be curious, not judgmental. And, you know, when you have that filter bubble, it doesn't allow you to be curious because you only see things that you agree with. And when people hold different views to our own, I'd like to see a situation where we seek to understand why people think differently. So, because failing to be curious leads to bias and stereotypes and misunderstandings and assumptions and hostility and separation. And intelligent debate, as David says, is a positive thing, definitely. I think the only other thing I was going to say was, I think to say something positive about social media, it has helped us to understand the kinds of issues that audiences want to know about, because it has given us that feedback on what does well. And it's also helped us to understand how we can communicate with our audiences in a way that they really respond to. So there is a positive there for news brands. I kind of touched on this before, but this idea that really, you know, if you produce a newspaper, you don't necessarily know how you're performing till the end of the week and you get the sales through, and you don't actually know whether it's the weather that has had a greater impact than what you put on the front page. Whereas, you know, social media has been great in terms of understanding what the audience wants, and it's valuable for that.
Well, this last clip then neatly ties up those last two thoughts of yours, Frank, around, you know, critical thinking and the exchange of ideas and about the role of social media. And this is the last point I want to leave you with, Frank and David. This is Hannah in Dundee.
In some ways, I find it easier. I like go on Twitter a lot. So I like, they make it easier. A lot of political parties and their manifestos are easily available there. But I don't really pay attention to like the media a lot of the time on like how it influences my vote. I feel like I stick to one particular party and I will vote with them a lot of the time.
And so back to you, Frank. How do we, or even should we, engage with people who are completely tribal in their politics, who'll vote for my country right or wrong, who are dyed-in-the-wool Labour supporters, Conservatives, SNP, whoever it is, if that's their tribe, how do we talk to them?
It's difficult. I think that's where trust comes in. Transparency comes in. I think often we've got to publish in the places where they will see. So often if people have a perception that our brands don't reflect their views, they might not necessarily buy us in print or come to our website. So we have to go and try and publish places where they will see us and try to show consistently that we are fair, that we have the best interests of our region at heart, and to show that we are relevant to their lives. But some people are not going to be persuaded, of course not. But we've just got to hold ourselves to a high standard and consistently talk about and debate the issues that matter. And hopefully people will see that that is something that is valuable, that a forum for intelligent debate is valuable.
David, last thought to you. What are you feeling about the election coming up?
Well, I'm excited to see what happens. I think that, as we've discussed, the stakes are very high. And just a few weeks ago, we thought the question was going to be, do the SNP get a majority, or is there a pro-independence majority, and who comes second? I think those questions are still very important and still in the balance. Obviously, Alex Salmond and his new Alibi party has complicated matters and made more drama. But I think what I would like to see from this election and what I would hope that the Courier and the Press and Journal can maybe add to it is that what we're talking about there, about the importance and the issues that matter, and trying to have a respectful debate about those issues as well as the other issues that will always be important at an election time. In the research, there was a young girl from Perth who we surveyed and who provided some comments for it. And she was pretty distressed, really, about where we are with the coronavirus pandemic. She didn't have much hope for the future. She was worried about job prospects for her generation and how health services would cope and how the economy would cope as we come out of the pandemic. And she was in the category, I think, that you were describing there, where she's always voted for the same party. And she said she would vote for them. And what struck me about that was, I'm not sure she recognized her agency, that if she's worried about these things, that she can debate them here and the people will listen, the politicians will listen, that there is, you can have influence, that the world doesn't just have to be something that happens to you. It can be something that you influence, and elections are one of the times when you can do that. So I would like to help shape the debate in that regard, not towards any type of outcome or conclusion, but to put in the issues that matter to the people who live and work in the communities we represent at the heart of this election.
Thank you both very much. If listening to this, you decide that you should be a more regular reader of the Courier and the Press and Journal, you should know that you can get 30 days of access, unlimited access, completely free to both websites, to everything that's happening on the politics, election hubs, and all the other reporting that these papers do across their communities. Just go to thecourier.co.uk/subscribe or pressandjournal.co.uk/subscribe. And the details and terms are in the episode notes. Don't forget, there is a regular episode of The Stooshie out this Friday, as there is every Friday, bringing together political minds from across the DC Thompson Media portfolio of political reporters and news brands to help you be better briefed ahead of the Hollywood elections and beyond. I've been Chris Finn. Thank you so much for joining me. We'll catch you Friday.
The Stooshie is the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media, bringing together political journalists and commentators from all over the country so that you can be better briefed. Teams at The Courier, The Press and Journal, The Evening Telegraph, Evening Express and The Sunday Post work hard day and night, online, in print and beyond, to bring you careful reporting and analysis designed to help you understand the implications of what happens in Holyrood, in Westminster and in our communities. So you don't miss an episode, follow The Stooshie today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you know folk like you who want to understand politics in Scotland a little better, suggest they tune into The Stooshie or follow Stooshie Scott on Twitter and Facebook. You can get a free month of unlimited access to The Courier or The Press and Journal too. Just go to thecourier.co.uk/subscribe or pressandjournal.co.uk/subscribe or follow the links in the episode notes to be better briefed. Check the episode notes for details and terms.